Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ways to live a little better. And today we have in the studio Dr. Neil Schachter. Dr. Neil Schachter is the medical director of the Respiratory Care Department of Mount Sinai Hospital, professor of medicine in Mount Sinai, and author of two very interesting books. Well, quite a few interesting books coming up, the Good Doctor books. The Good Doctor's Guide to Colds and Flu. Very interesting book because Dr. Schachter is going to talk to us about the difference between colds and flus and everything else, but mainly the most important one, Life and Breath. Life and Breath, one of the best books I've ever seen on breathing, on lungs, on lung health. And, you know, we've been for a long while listening to many people here on WBAI talk about the importance of having adequate oxygen in your system. But I thought it would be not a bad idea to have Dr. Schachter on talking to us about just giving us basics on lung health and what it is. Neil, welcome to WBAI.
Armin, thank you for having me.
Let me ask you something. I'm going to ask you a very complex question. What is a lung?
Well, first of all, we have two of them. They are...
Do we need two?
We do need two because they serve as a reserve for the body. One would be difficult to manage, and split the way they are, they function well within the chest. I mean, the chest is a bellows, and in order to bring the good air in and to get the bad air out, you do need the setup that we actually have.
So what does a lung do?
Well, first and foremost, everybody is aware that 24/7 we are breathing, and the major purpose of that is to bring oxygen in, oxygen which is one of the major gases that exists in the atmosphere around us, and to exhale out, to breathe out the waste product of the body's metabolism, which is carbon dioxide. Without that constant influx of oxygen, which is the fuel which keeps the body going, we would die within minutes. But the lung functions on many other levels. The lung functions as a protective mechanism. As you could imagine, every day we're exposed to all the pollutants, the germs that are suspended in the atmosphere. And as such, the lung has to have specific properties so that it can defend you as an immune organ.
So the lung is more than just a bellows taking in oxygen and pumping it into your blood. It's acting as a filtering system.
Absolutely.
As well. And the more damaged the lung, the more important, I guess, this filtering system is.
Well, the more damage there is, the more compromised the lungs are, and the more precarious the situation is for the person. But the good news is that because we have two lungs, and because they function so well, there's tremendous reserve. And depending on what kind of damage is done to the lungs, a person can subsist on perhaps half the capacity that we normally have.
Half the normal capacity. Now, one of the chapters in your book, of course, which we would expect, is you can always stop smoking or something to that effect. People who have smoked cigarettes for many, many years usually have damage to their lungs, don't they?
Well, the number one enemy that we have, of course, is cigarette smoke. If you have to choose the list of known causes of damage to the lung in terms of chronic obstructive lung disease, in terms of lung cancer, cigarette smoke is far and away the most important cause. There are other causes, but cigarette smoke is our number one enemy.
What are the other causes?
Well, some of the major causes are air pollutants, the wastes of our industrialized society, and some people are just more sensitive to the natural compounds that are out there. I'm talking about people with allergies. I'm talking about people with asthma. They just respond more strongly to normal suspended particle matters that are out there, such as plant material, fur from animals, the fumes off of the odors off of trees and grasses and flowers. They respond just much more strikingly to those because their immune system is revved up.
So, well, would you say that a person who responds more to allergies and to, asthma is practically all allergy, isn't it? Isn't it a form, isn't it an allergic reaction?
As we understand more and more of allergy, of asthma, it appears that most of it has as its basis an allergic basis. But adults, for children, it's almost invariably true, 90% or more of children who develop asthma do so on the basis of allergy. On the other hand, in adults, the relationship is less clear-cut, but there's a relationship nonetheless.
The people who are more sensitive, who are more allergic than other people, do they have compromised immune system, or is it just a different kind of immune system? I mean, maybe you were born to be on Mars and not on the, you know, not on the Earth. Maybe you had a different kind of lung setup. Is it a matter of damage to be allergic? Is it a matter of a compromised system?
It's a matter of different response. I mean, people, animals, living things have to respond to their environment, and the environment changes all the time. Something that was appropriate 100,000 years ago or even a year ago may not be appropriate today.
What do you mean? Give me an example.
Well, for example, air pollution. The kind of air pollution that we have now, we didn't have before the Industrial Revolution. Cigarette smoke. We didn't have cigarette smoke before we came to America. So there are many changes in the environment that the body has to accommodate, and the body is not that rapid in getting those changes through.
In evolving and doing all that necessary stuff,
right,
to make you adapt to a polluted environment.
It's felt, for example, that the antibodies that we make for allergy were of use to us, and continue to be of use to us nowadays, to protect us against parasites, worms, malarial infection. These are the situations where that kind of antibody comes in. Certainly in the civilized world, we are less exposed to those, but those antibodies persist, and there's a whole range of response. So those who respond more tend to develop these unwanted side effects, which are allergies.
This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind. Neil Schachter, Director of Respiratory Care Department at Mount Sinai Hospital, is with us. We're talking about respiratory health, and we're talking about lungs and breathing. It's amazing how much stuff there is to consider that people don't consider. Let's talk a little bit about the damages that happen to the lungs, okay? Can you categorize them? Can you tell me what is the most common thing?
Well, the most common damage to the lung is airway disease. This is an irritation from breathing, primarily from breathing in outside irritants, cigarette smoke being the most common one. And now let me specify that not everybody who smokes develops airway disease. Only about 15 to 20% of smokers do develop airway disease and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD.
How do you account for that? How do you account for a two-pack-a-day smoker being okay in their lungs? Did you ever see it? Did you ever see clean lungs on a two-pack-a-day smoker?
The answer to that is yes. They may develop other problems. There virtually is not a chronic disease out there today that isn't in some way related to cigarette smoking. And some you would be very surprised to. Heart disease, it's not so surprising. Cigarette smoke contains carbon monoxide, which poisons red blood cells and blocks oxygen from getting to the body. So the fact that cigarette smoke can potentiate heart disease is not all that amazing. But do you know that cigarette smoking is also associated with diabetes, that you have twice as great a chance of developing diabetes if you're a smoker than if you're not a smoker? So every day we're learning that this pollutant that we've foisted upon ourselves is actually associated with most of the chronic diseases that we know of today.
One of the things I love about your book is that there's no judgment. There's so much shame associated with having lung disease. People, especially smokers, are afraid to go to their doctors. I notice as you go through your book, there's no judgment about smokers. You don't feel a judgment. You don't say, oh, you're stupid, you're lazy, there's something wrong with you.
Smoking is an addiction, and like every addiction, doctors have to treat it. And the only way to treat it is to tell the patient you have an addiction, and to share with him all the ways that that you know that he can or she can get beyond that addiction.
You don't feel a criticism of people.
Absolutely not. No, we all grew up in an age where cigarette smoking was glamorous. Every starlet smoked on the silver screen. Cigarettes were advertised on television, on radio. It was the thing to do.
Did you smoke at one point?
I smoked a few cigarettes. I never got into it as a habit.
I was going to say you never inhaled.
I never inhaled. No, I did inhale, but not to any extent. I was caught up in the same tidal wave that everybody else was. I mean, it all started basically with World War II. With cigarette companies being the good guys and sending free cigarettes to our boys overseas and leading an entire generation to be addicted.
They actually, you know, one of the other traces they had on Modern Marvels, one of our favorite programs, was that it really all started with the machines that rolled the paper, that rolled the cigarettes. That until you had to roll the cigarettes yourself, not too good in a war. You know, in the First World War, if you got to stop and roll a cigarette while you're being shot at, well, that's not so easy. But the fact that they had these pre-rolled cigarettes in a pack, that was the secret. So the real thing was the rolling paper. That's the one that made it work.
I mean, it put it in the category of industrialized poison, if you will.
Available, and we sent it to all our soldiers because it was what we thought would help them, you know, get through.
Right, and you may remember, and I do very vividly, all the ads in Life and Look, where you had 9 out of 10 doctors prefer Camels to any other cigarette. And then there's the T-zone, one of my favorites, which seems to map out the throat, saying milder and better for your throat, helps digestion. All these things were thrown out there to help legitimize and to help even make cigarettes seem to be therapeutic.
Did you say something once about Kent cigarettes that I overheard? This is an interesting story.
Yeah. Kent cigarettes, one of the first filtered cigarettes, their micronized filter, their filter that was supposedly used in atomic energy plants to keep the air pure, was made of asbestos. And of course, we know now that the combination of cigarette smoke and asbestos is multiplicative in terms of generating lung cancer. So not only are you adding toxins, but you're multiplying them when you use that combination.
Amazing, amazing how we got through it as much as we did. Lung disease, okay, the lung kind of damages we're talking about. Restrictive airway, you talk about airway disorders, and you're saying when we say airways, airway is, what is that, a tube?
These are the tubes. You can actually feel the major tube, which moves through, which is in your neck, which we call the trachea. That's the single tube that goes from the back of your throat down into your chest and divides up and begins a splitting into many, many branches. And these branches form the airways, which conduct air from the outside world to the very smallest sections of your lung.
Now, are the airways in the lungs? Is that what you're talking about?
The airways pretty much are the bulk of the lungs.
That's the lung itself.
Yes.
I mean, that you have all these airways in there.
Most of the lung is air. Most of the lung is just empty space into which air is conducted. But surrounding that air, there's tissue, and most of that tissue is formed by the conducting airways, the small tubes that split up from that single tube that originates in the neck. Ultimately, those small airways end in little tiny pouches or balloons, if you will, which are wafer thin, microscopically thin, and allow oxygen to go from the airway side to the blood side, because the lung is very rich in blood vessels, and at that level, oxygen goes from the airway into the blood vessel, is picked up by red blood cells, transmitted to the rest of the body, and from those red blood cells, carbon dioxide is transferred into the airways where it's exhaled.
You have to get rid of carbon dioxide.
Absolutely.
You must get rid of it, right? Not like a plant.
You can't commit suicide by holding your breath. The body has developed a system where your breathing is triggered by high levels of carbon dioxide. So when you hold your breath and the level of carbon dioxide in your blood goes up, there develops an irresistible urge for you to breathe. And that's not something you may pass out, but the reflex takes over and you start to breathe again before you die.
Accumulation of carbon dioxide, though, seems to be, is that as a result of damaged lungs? Because a lot of people have that, you know, especially exercise or climbing a flight of stairs. I remember a man named Butenko, who I once took a class with, who had a whole thing about ridding yourself of carbon dioxide as much as you can, and it was the focus of his training.
Well, actually, you don't have to do very much. The body is exquisitely engineered to get rid of carbon dioxide. The amount of carbon dioxide in your blood is controlled very, very carefully by centers in your brain that adjust your breathing to the level of carbon dioxide in there. The minute it starts to go up, this irresistible urge, which I've told you about, to breathe faster. As you exercise and your body metabolizes more, converts oxygen and sugar into carbon dioxide, you breathe more deeply, you breathe more rapidly, and you blow the carbon dioxide off. So as long as the lung is functioning well, and there's enough membrane to exchange that carbon dioxide for oxygen, then there's no problem. It's all taken care of you. It's like the janitor in your building. You just have to trust him. But if the lung is damaged, if your brain is damaged, then the system no longer works.
Whoops. Let's go to that for a moment. Let's talk about how brain damage affects the system.
Right. Well, we normally can control our breathing. In other words, right now as I'm talking, I'm adjusting my breathing to account for the fact that I am talking to you. When we exercise, you don't really have to think about it. You breathe more rapidly. But you can modify that by your central control. Obviously, if there's enough central brain damage, you lose that control. But more importantly, the control of the reflexes, which control your everyday breathing, making sure that for each time you breathe out, you breathe in, that's lodged inside of what we call the lower brain. That's the extension of the brain into the spinal canal. And in that area, there's a center that controls breathing. There are other centers, but that's one of the major.
In which area? We've got a fairly sophisticated, around the amygdala, around?
No, the brain sits in the cranial vault. Behind that, there's the cerebellum. And extending down from the brain, carrying all the nerves to the body, to the spinal cord, there's an intermediate area, which is called the posterior hindbrain, and that area is the site of many, many reflexes, in particular the reflexes which control breathing.
And damage there could...
Yes, can alter your breathing pattern and can even cause you to stop breathing.
Armand DeMille here. There is so much. We could do this. This could be a marathon program. There is so much information, and I'm so grateful for you being here because it's life and breath for a lot of people. Dr. Neil Schachter, S-C-H-A-C-T-E-R, is with us, author of Life and Breath. Which, if you ever wanted to pick up a book and learn about the lung and learn about what's going on for you, this is one that I really enjoyed. Okay, let's go a little further with the damages. We talk about airway disease, which is, I guess, like talking about lung disease. Is that the same thing as COPD?
Okay, let me make things clear at this point.
Go ahead,
point.
I'll leave it to you. You've
COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is a term that most doctors have now agreed upon should be used to characterize a number of diseases. It's an umbrella term. It covers emphysema, it covers chronic bronchitis, and it covers many forms of asthma. They all share many characteristics together, in particular that they affect the airways in one way or another. The problem with COPD is it's the gorilla, the 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody seems to notice. If I go out in the street, not myself personally, but if I send a polling service out into the street and ask people, you know, what is COPD, the last time that was done, which is just a few years ago, only about 14% of people had any idea what was being talked about. Even among physicians, COPD is not that well recognized. So there's a perception problem, there's a educational problem here. We're addressing it. The National Institutes of Health, which is the major branch of the government which supports research in the fields of heart and lung disease, they are launching a campaign to make COPD better known to the public. But in the meantime, there is a large gap between what the public knows, what physicians know, and what is done to treat it. Many physicians feel, unjustly so, that COPD is a death sentence. This is absolutely incorrect. COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is preventable, it's treatable, and in some cases it's reversible. So, you know, we have to get that message out that there we understand this disease now, we know what causes it, we have many strategies to treat the symptoms, and we even have ways of making it better once it's started.
In addition to all the other treatments, which are probably medical treatments, right, most of them will be chemistry, there's also surgeries that are being done.
Yes, we do have surgery, but before we get to surgery, because that's usually reserved for the most severe cases of COPD, those who have gone beyond the point where simple medical and supportive measures are helpful. Now, when we talk about COPD, we have a classification system. It goes from pre-COPD, patients who are smokers and who are at risk of developing COPD, all the way to very severe. We have five classifications. This pre-COPD, mild, moderate, severe, and very severe. And this classification has been developed by a group that calls itself the Gold Committee, the Global Committee on Obstructive Lung Disease. And they have developed not only this classification, but a strategy for managing patients at the various stages of the disease. So at any stage of the disease, clearly the most important thing that you can do for yourself, and it's never too late, is that if you are a smoker, you need to stop smoking. You need to at least contemplate the possibility that you can stop smoking, because it is possible. just making the decision on yourself without any external help, you have about a 10% chance that if you make the decision, I'm going to try to stop smoking, you will be able to stop smoking. If you keep trying time and time again, that 10% is additive, and eventually people succeed. With medical help, and not everybody wants to go through doctors. I can understand that. There are other ways of doing it. But with medical help, the statistics are quite a bit better. But these are selected individuals, people who come to doctors and who ask to be helped. There, the batting average is up to 60%. Mm. So there is no doubt that smoking cessation does work. And the first step is to realize that you have a program and to realize that you can quit smoking.
And according to the GOLD classification system, once a person gets to, like, moderately severe or something like that, or moderate, and then what was the...
Moderate. So there's mild, moderate, severe, and very severe.
Now, once a person's at the severe level, can they drop down to the moderate level through corrective measures? Can you go backwards?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because there are reversible components. COPD is a disease that is not totally reversible, but it is partially reversible. Inflammation is the major reversible component of COPD. The airways become inflamed as a result of cigarette smoke. They become inflamed as a result of infection. They become inflamed as a result of air pollution. And there are many ways that we can protect and reduce those effects of inflammation. So the treatment that we have is aimed at, one, suppressing the symptoms that limit you, but also reducing the inflammation which causes the disease to progress.
Wow. And then you have, you know, you said something in your book which kind of startled me. It was about the effect of exercise, and it was that you said that exercise takes two muscles and breaks them down, or it takes a muscle and it actually breaks it down, that this is the effect of exercise, and then what you do is you build a new muscle on top of an old muscle, which is a stronger muscle, and that exercise therefore gives you more muscle capacity for your lungs?
Well, that's sort of the picture.
What I missed. It was intriguing.
Damage does occur with exercise, and it's a good thing because it helps the muscle to hypertrophy, which means to get bigger. And bigger muscles are stronger muscles. We train two types of muscles. We train muscles for strength, and we train them for endurance. And remember, the lung is working 24/7, so you need muscles to have a lot of endurance, not just strength. We don't want the muscles of breathing to lift 300 pounds. We want them to be there when you need them, to keep functioning day in and day out. And we do have training methods that concentrate on the muscles of respiration to help you when the standard muscles are not enough.
Most people don't know the diaphragm is a muscle, isn't it?
The diaphragm is our major muscle of respiration. As we sit here right now, that's the major muscle that we use to breathe. It is, and I hope I'm saying this right, indefatigable. It works as long as you do. It keeps on going. I forget what it was
battery.
The Bulova watch. Keeps on ticking, and you give it a licking. So it is the muscle that is with you from the day you're born until the day you die. It is made of special fibers that do not get tired under usual circumstance. If you stress them, if you increase your breathing up beyond a certain percentage, normally we breathe at about 5% the maximum capacity that we can breathe. If we go above 40 or 50% of that capacity, those muscles get tired. And here's the problem with COPD. In COPD, the lung changes its shape. And the diaphragms, which have this nice semicircular appearance, which allows them to move up and down as you breathe and suck air in, are flattened because the lung hyperexpands, it overexpands when COPD develops. And as a result, the diaphragm no longer works efficiently. So you have to count on accessory muscles, other muscles, muscles in your neck, muscles in your shoulder, to help move the chest wall to help you with your breathing. These are muscles that we normally use when the diaphragm cannot fully accomplish its mission.
My guest is Dr. Neil Schachter. This is incredible information. We're going to take a very short break, my friends, and when we come back, we're going to be going into this further.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener-supported and non-commercial.
And this is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Tiny mishap on our music before, but not so bad. We get over it right away because we can recover like the lung can recover. Our guest in the studio, Neil Schachter. Dr. Neil Schachter, Neil, I got to ask you something about your background. You are such a knowledgeable man, and you have such an ability to teach. I've seen you teach. I've seen people respond. You can translate some of this stuff into language that people can understand, which I think is a beautiful gift. I mean, it seems to be the most important to communicating to people. You do in your book, certainly, Life and Breath. And you do when you speak, and I've seen you at a blackboard. So Neil, you got to have a background that brings you here, and there is one remarkable person in your past that I want to give a mention to. Do you mind?
Absolutely not.
Let's talk about your dad.
Let's do it.
Yeah, tell me about him.
Well, my dad was a World War II refugee. He was born in Poland. He grew up in Vienna. He studied at University of Vienna Medical School. He wanted to be a pathologist. Then World War II came up, and he became a refugee. And he traveled through Europe looking for a safe haven. He wound up in France, where he met my mother, who was a French teacher, also a refugee from Romania. And he had a narrow escape in France. He got put in a concentration, what they called a concentration camp. It was a camp for foreign nationals. Through his ingenuity, he was able to get himself out of it, and he escaped ultimately to come to America, as so many others did. He picked up the sticks of his life. The hardest test he had ever had to pass was his immigration test. He thought that he had failed it because One of his statements was, it's a pleasure to be here in the United States of America. He mispronounced United, and he felt that it was all over, but I guess they took pity on him, and they needed doctors, and he was in. He did a residency in Harlem Hospital here in New York as a pathologist, and then ultimately became a general practitioner, something that we see less and less of nowadays. And he must have known half of the Bronx by their first name. I mean, his office was always crammed with patients. It was an incredible sight. I mean, they were. We lived in the office. We had sort of the back room and the office with its X-ray machine and you know, all his lab stuff, which he kept in one room.
Where in the Bronx was this?
We were near 149th Street. If you're familiar with the geography, Avenue St. John, corner Beck Street.
So right up there, and there you are in the Bronx when you're
right.
And your dad's doing this practice. Now, you're how old are you at the time? Do you remember your dad until you throughout your childhood?
Oh, yeah. We were there. I was there. We lived there till I was a teenager.
So you saw this whole thing going on, which was, I mean, he's known for being like this incredible humanitarian.
Well, his whole life was his practice. You know, he got up in the morning, and he was out seeing patients, house calls, and always a full office until midnight. So he had a very full life.
You consider that kind of doctoring still available in this world? I mean, I know. I think you come as close to it as I've seen anybody. Well, I've seen you do hands-on work with people or care about people at levels that I don't see many people do, you know? There's a woman I met the other day, and I was over at Mount Sinai Hospital. I met a woman who said she was in a coma for 6 months, and everybody had given up on her, but not you, and you visited her practically every day is the story they tell, and she came out of this coma as a result of your interventions or at least your attention. Is that true, or is this?
Well, I don't like to give up. I mean, medicine nowadays, you know, is pulled by various forces, not all of them based on medicine, and not that I'm saying that anybody gives up, but there is a need to move patients, if you will, it's hard resisting that trend. But
specialization is what people do. I met a man who said he specialized. He was a dermatologist, and I said, why? He said, so I never get a call in the middle of the night. He said, so I'll choose that as my profession.
Well, you know, it's not so much what you do, but how you practice it. I mean, you know, I hate to label any specialty as, you know, less dedicated than any other. It really depends on the individual.
You watched your dad do this year after year after year, and I mean, here it is, houses full of things. He never kind of slept. He was with it the whole way. What was your feeling during all that time?
It was the most exciting thing that I ever saw. I mean, I used to go on calls with him. You know, he didn't take me up to see the patients, but he would come back and tell me about them, the anecdotes. And there was always something that I learned each time I went with him.
Each time you'd learn something new about medicine, actually?
You know, it wasn't always medicine. It was, you know, people.
Give me an example. Tell me a story that you remember hearing that really just was like one of the most exciting things you heard your dad doing.
You know, I remember I went out with him one night on a call, and he said, I have to visit this lawyer. They just called me. She's very, very sick. She has diabetes. She has heart failure. She's had an partial amputation. And he went up there, and he said, oh, she's desperately sick. And, you know, they weren't as ready. People didn't send people to the hospital as readily in those days. He treated her at home. He gave her a shot of what was the major diuretic at those days, something called mercurohydrin. Gave her digitalis. Those were the principal things that we had to treat heart failure in those days. And then, you know, I asked them the next day, what happened? Well, he said, I went back, and she was sitting there knitting a sweater for me. So, you know, it's that kind of, you know, turnaround that you could see as the result of the things that you actually, the hands-on thing. It's not like you delegate this. You send somebody for an MRI, and then they have to go through all sorts of things. You do a treatment, and they get better. That, I can't think of anything more rewarding than that.
Hmm. Don't you think of making millions of dollars and buying a great house is more rewarding than doing a treatment that...
You know, as William James says, there in my house there are many rooms, and everybody is different.
So you watched this with your dad, and it was, I'm sure, inspiring. Did that lead you to medicine itself?
Well, I have to say that, you know, I was very interested in science, but I don't think I would have gone into medicine if I hadn't loved to watch my dad do what he did.
When did your dad die?
He died just before I finished medical school.
Wow. That's quite an interesting thing. So he died and you kind of picked up right after the end of it.
Well, you know, I did what I did.
What made you specialize in pulmonary?
Well, like with everything else, it's the people you meet along the way that sort of give you the drive, the interest. I met some very fascinating people who were my teachers, my colleagues, and they all pointed me in the right direction. In medical school and as a house officer, I trained here at Bellevue Hospital. I had one of the grand old men of tuberculosis who led the chest service at Bellevue, a man by the name of John McClement. And he was a very personable physician. Every time he saw a patient, he would ask them how they were doing, and if they were feeling better, he would say, I'm glad you're feeling better. And that I thought was a touch that you don't often hear. You know, he was one of the people that helped bring tuberculosis under control here in New York City, and he taught us a tremendous amount. I did a fellowship at Yale University, and I was interested in air pollution and in occupational medicine, and there was a physician from Holland there by the name of Aaron Bauhaus, who was a very bright man, and had done tremendously interesting studies on lung disease, and he just had a knack of explaining things, of being able to convey to you what it meant to prove that something was real or not real. He had written books, and he taught. He was just a very strong, influential character.
A mentor to you, an informer, and touched you because you seem to have developed that style. He was a specialist in pollutants?
Air pollution and in occupational lung disease.
Well, that's pretty advanced for his time, wasn't it?
He was among the first, yeah. This was when people were just coming to the realization, particularly in this country. England was ahead of us because they'd had some of these major air pollution crises in London, the fogs of the 50s that had caused tremendous death. But nobody had really proven the links between air pollution and lung disease. And he was one of the first to undertake large prospective epidemiologic studies to show that.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the pollutants. You know, I want to talk about them because there was this thing about fireplaces. I want to just talk about a wood-burning fireplace, which has always been so, so attractive. For people with compromised breathing systems, I guess not, you don't even have to have a compromised breathing system. A wood-burning fireplace is not the healthiest of all elements to be in, is it?
Anytime you burn organic material, you create a plume of toxins. These are either in the form of particulates. These are little particles that are the result of the burning. They're the cinders, if you will, but they're microscopic.
Particulates. I want to get our audience loves new words.
Uh-huh. But also gases. Every time you burn anything that that contains carbon, you're going to develop carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, all sorts of pollutants.
So aerosols, things that people use in the air, all of those things are particulates.
Any suspended matter that is not in gas form would be a particulate. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get back to fireplaces.
Yeah.
Right, so now we have a wood-burning fireplace,
right.
And you have, coming off that, some particulates which are not too healthy for the lungs.
Just as the particulates coming off from cigarette smoke are not healthy for the lungs. It's the same type of pollution.
Well, what if people burn those fake logs?
Well, those fake logs are if you're talking about the ones that have an accelerant,
mm-hmm.
so that they burn more quickly, that's just adding fuel to the fire, if you pardon the imagery. Basically, what you're doing is you're adding more chemical and organic material to something already complex, and they cause even more irritating fumes to be developed.
Hmm. Perfumed candles. How's that? Now, that can't possibly hurt you. They're just candles, right?
Well, it depends. There are degrees of sensitivity. Some people walk into a store full of candles that will knock over a 6-foot-tall person and will not complain at all. I mean, there are degrees. Just as not everybody who smokes cigarettes will develop airway disease, not everybody who walks into a candle store will be overwhelmed by the smell. But it is an irritant. There are irritant fumes from candles.
There's more among the things that will happen in the air, as well as particulates. Among the pollutants, there's NO2.
Yes.
Right? O3, SO2. Can we talk about all three of those? Ozone,
yes.
Nitrogen oxide.
Nitrogen dioxide, yes.
Nitrogen dioxide comes out of cars?
It does. It's a pollutant that results from the burning of fuels, exactly. It also results from the burning of gas in your gas stove. So these are, whenever you burn, you're also burning the nitrogen in the air. So the combination of oxygen and nitrogen produces oxides of nitrogen, in particular nitrogen dioxide.
And it seems to be particularly harmful.
It is one of the major pollutants that the Environmental Protection Agency follows and regulates. It has its own properties of causing damage. I won't say that it's more serious than any other. It all depends on the circumstance.
Someone once told me a story. You know, I know your office is near Central Park.
Yes.
Or the hospital is near Central Park. Sometimes Park Drive is open and sometimes it's closed, and that's when you could drive through the park.
Can never figure that out.
Well, the part of the reason that started was not because the bicyclists started demanding that we have a clean air, but because the trees were dying in the summer. During the growing period, during the hottest part of the growing period, there was all these pollutants that were coming out in that 100-degree heat, and the trees just started dropping off. So they said, you know, it might be a smart thing to close the park to heavy traffic in those mid-hot hours.
Yeah. There are primary health consequences to pollution and secondary health consequences. Primary health consequences are the consequences to you or I. The secondary health consequences, which the government takes just as seriously as those primary health consequences, are the deterioration of the environment. And trees are like the canaries of the coal mines. They are so dependent on the oxygen and the air that we all breathe, that they are very sensitive to pollution.
Do you think there's any truth to the fact that when a person gets out of town for a weekend and gets over to the beach or up to the mountains and they just breathe for a weekend, that they're somehow repairing their lungs? Just getting away, do you think? You think fresh salt air really does anything for you, or it just feels like it does?
Well, there are many physicians in Hungary that send their patients to salt mines for asthma cures. I'm not sure that I believe in this. I'm not sure that there have been any controlled studies. But, you know, certainly people feel good at the beach. They feel good when the air is relatively clean. However, be careful. Not all clean air, as we normally think of it, is that clean. The country, which we usually consider cleaner than the city, is full of organic pollutants. So if you have allergies, the country may be exactly the wrong place for you to be. Someplace like Florida, which is very warm and moist, or the Gulf Coast, which is very warm and moist, which favors the development of molds and these sorts of things, can exacerbate airway conditions such as asthma.
Boy, there's so much more we could say. I know I was just thinking about that. We have just about 5 minutes. Colds and Flu, The Good
Right.
Doctor's Guide to Colds and Flu by Neil Schachter. Another book, and this is one of a series of Good Doctor books, hopefully. But the difference between a cold and a flu, Neil, we just have about 5 minutes. Take it away. Give it to me.
Okay, I use what's called the neck sign. If the symptoms are above the neck, that tends to be a cold. If the symptoms are below the neck, it tends to be the flu. The cold, it can occur year round, but like with most respiratory infections, occurs in winter season because of the closed environment. Because kids are in school, they transmit the disease. The same is true for influenza. Influenza usually develops as a viral disease does, initially with some non-chest symptoms, headache, fever. It's only after about 2 or 3 days that the virus takes hold in the lung and causes coughing some phlegm production, can be shortness of breath, and in the most severe cases can cause pneumonia.
But it's very important, if you've got compromised lung system, to be able to identify the difference between a flu and a cold at the very beginning.
Yes.
How would you tell the difference?
Well,
at the beginning, before you get that 3 days.
The flu tends to present with a high fever, over 102 colds. Usually, if there is a fever, it tends to be 100 or less. For colds, usually cough is not a prominent symptom. It's not a deep-seated cough. Congestion, watery eyes, stuffy ears, those are the symptoms of a cold. Cough, chest pain, those are the symptoms of the flu.
If we had about another 24 hours, we could just barely get into this. I guess it took you a long time to learn all this stuff. You can't tell it all to us in 1 hour?
Well, I've tried to give you some interesting pebbles that I've picked up along the way. I wrote the Good Doctor's Guide sort of as a sequel to Life and Breath, because respiratory infections are among the more reversible things that you can treat in patients with chronic obstructive lung disease. And understanding these respiratory infections, treating them, can help prevent and, in some cases, reverse the course of some of these more severe lung diseases.
Neil Schachter, Schachter, the book Life and Breath, available through Amazon.
Armand, I'm going to correct you, Schachter, and you can find some information on the web at thegooddoctor1.com.
Thegooddoctor1.com, Life and Breath. Thank you so much for being with us. You think there's a shot we can get you back here for a couple of more hours?
Why not? I'm in the city.
Yes, this is a great thing. Okay, we'll be back with you on Tuesday, my friends. This is Armand, and we'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1, and look forward to doing more good and interesting stuff. If you want a copy of today's program, if you want to hear today's program, or send today's program to someone, you can go to my website, thepositivemind.com, download the program and mail it, or you can get it through iTunes. Bye-bye for now, my friends.